This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This year, the American Society of Cinematographers gave its Lifetime Achievement Award to Haskell Wexler. It was the first time an active cinematographer received the honor. A retrospective of Wexler's work will be presented at the Museum of the Moving Image in New York next month. Wexler won Oscars for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Bound for Glory, received an Oscar nomination for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Meet Juan. His other films include Colors, Coming Home, The Hoodlum Priest, America, America, and In the Heat of the Night. He also directed some very controversial documentaries, including Introduction to the Enemy, about the trip Jane Fonda made to North Vietnam during the war. Wexler wrote, directed, and shot Medium Cool, a 1970 feature film about a TV news cameraman during the riots at the Democratic Convention in Chicago. During the 40 years that Wexler has worked in film, the technology has changed dramatically. When he was starting out, he shot in black and white and had to use ingenuity when he didn't have the technology to get the shot he wanted.
Well, when I started, we had just the camera and the person mostly. And if you wanted to do a dolly shot, particularly working in Chicago where I began, you'd get in the back of the trunk of a car and you'd have a friend drive the car, or you'd get in some kid's little wagon that he plays with and have someone pull that for dolly shots. Lighting was very primitive, and still it was really the way to learn, because sometimes some of the modern technology is so extreme and so compartmentalized that we lose sight of exactly what we're doing.
Is there a shot for a feature film that you did in a kid's wagon getting pulled along?
Oh, I used to do that all the time. In fact, I kept a wagon that was a young boy lived next door to me, and I kept his wagon until he was about 18 years old and used it on a number of documentaries in Chicago.
But not feature films?
No, in feature films, even on Virginia Woolf, I had a thing which the grips called the paraplegic, which was a wheelchair thing that I had made up years before, where I could stand on this bicycle-like device and be pushed down the hall and then step off it with a handheld camera. I used it in a shot where Richard Burton goes down the hall to get a gun in a closet, and I wanted to get some excitement. The hallway was too narrow for the dollies that they had at that time, so it was quite useful.
You did one of the early helicopter shots for films, and thinking of the last shot in the movie Picnic, and you were the second unit cinematographer on that. Would you describe the shot and how you did it?
Well, the helicopter was a U.S. Navy helicopter. There were no civilian helicopters available to film companies. And so they just made some stuff out of 2x4 wood, and I would straddle a 2x4 out from the helicopter with the camera on a what we call a hi-hat, which is a low metal stand. We were shooting CinemaScope on that film, which is anamorphic, so the lens is very big, and of course the cameras in those days were very heavy. And I had a rope around my waist, and the rope was attached into the helicopter in case I fell off. And the shot was a shot that began with Kim Novak going out of a house and getting into a bus. And then it was supposed to go over the countryside and find a freight train on which Bill Holden was standing. And then after seeing a good look at the freight train, the camera was supposed to move up into the sky for the end credits.
So let me get this straight. You were not in the helicopter, but dangling outside of it on a 2x4?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, there's a still picture of me. I had forgotten it, actually, because that just... I didn't think anything of it. Yeah, we'd sit on it like on a horse, on a 2x4, and holding onto the camera.
What did it feel like? It must have been a real dizzying feeling.
Well, you know, the whole idea of fear when you're looking through the camera is a different phenomenon. I mean, I've been in wars and in riots and hung out of many helicopters in the early days. And there's a detachment that happens when you look through the camera. You're looking for the shot. And it's only in recent years that I think about myself as being a vulnerable human being, even if I am a cameraman.
What do you think of that now, because you've gotten older?
Well, yeah, I don't do helicopter shots anymore. I just think maybe my time is running out as far as, because there have been a number of accidents and of cameramen hurting themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once in a Western I was shooting, that stuntman was supposed to jump off a cliff, and he was supposed to fall off the cliff, and he did it extremely poorly. It was a low-budget Western. So I was very angry, and I said, "Damn it! This is how you do it. I'm going to do a terrific shot." So I had a little hand camera, and I jumped off this cliff, and there was a big mattress about 15 feet below, which I was supposed to fall on, but I didn't, and I just sort of nicked it, and then rolled down the rest of the hillside, and they took me to the hospital, and all the way to the hospital and everything, I said, "Oh God, I don't care. I got the greatest, most real jump-off shot that ever was." And then when we did see the shot, all it was, you just see some blur of sky and some bushes, and it was it may have been realistic, but it wasn't a good shot.
Now, you were a cinematographer on the film Gimme Shelter, which was the concert film at the Altamont Festival.
Terror. I have to explain it. I was not the cinematographer on Give Me Shelter. I was going to be, and I met with Mick for a week and a half while they were trying to figure out where they were going to have the concert. And then at the last minute, I was worried because things were so up in the air, and I was around so many weird people. It was weird to me at that time, you know, with teeny boppers and grass being smoked and all kinds of crazy things going on, that I called my friends the Maisels in New York, and the Maisels shot Gimme Shelter.
Oh, so you didn't work on it?
No, I didn't work on it. I did give refuge to the Maisels after the concert, because the... I'm trying to think of how much of this I should say. The people who were involved in the killing that happened at Altamont threatened the lives of the Maisels. And so they hid out at my place in Malibu, and until they were able to work a deal to buy them a new Harley Davidson. And then the death threat against the Maisels was released.
So these people wanted the Maisels dead unless they destroyed the footage?
They said that they were life actors in the Maisels film, and they wanted to be paid $40,000 for being life actors in a dramatic film.
Huh.
This was the Hells Angels. I'm sure none of them are around anymore.
Right.
It was settled. A digger named Emmett Grogan worked the transaction for us, so that the contract on the Maisels was lifted.
My guest is cinematographer Haskell Wexler, and he this year got the American Society of Cinematographers Lifetime Achievement Award. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is cinematographer Haskell Wexler. He won Academy Awards for his work on Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf and Bound for Glory, and he got Oscar nominations for his work on Matewan and Blaze. You've done a lot of documentary work throughout your career. On your feature Medium Cool, which you wrote, directed, and shot, you used documentary footage, even though it was a fiction feature film. And part of the documentary footage that you used was of the organizing at the Chicago Convention and the riots there. You were actually shooting during some tear gassing, and you got gassed while you were shooting.
Yes, I did. And so did some members of our crew. There was no actually stock footage in Medium Cool. I wrote the script. I wrote the riots. And I integrated the actors in the film in the park during the demonstrations. But nowhere was it like we had stock footage and then later in editing integrated in the film. It was all done at the time.
So when you were shooting the demonstration that ended up getting tear gassed and you got gassed yourself, I imagine you had to stop shooting then.
Yes, I had to stop shooting. I certainly didn't know that tear gas felt like it has, like it does. I don't know whether you've ever experienced it, but when you hear the word tear gas, you think, well, your eyes will burn and that's it. But that whole feeling of your skin burning, that you can't breathe, you can't inhale, you feel suffocated, it's a very, very terrifying experience.
One of the issues in Medium Cool is, does being behind the camera, shooting the action, remove you from the action and remove you from any responsibility for what happens? Was that a big issue for you personally?
Yes, I think that the whole voyeuristic attitude of filmmakers, or of me personally, of shooting documentaries and so forth, is an important issue, and it was an important issue to me personally. And the whole question of when do you put the camera down, and or when do you keep shooting to get the shot? And a number of times in my life, I've had that question hit me very hard. When I was in Vietnam with Jane Fonda, I was shooting a farmer in the field, just a pastoral scene. And while I was shooting him, an explosion occurred. He blew up right in my lens, so to speak. And he had stepped in a landmine. And some people came out. They were like paramedics. Came out from a little clinic and carried him in to this little house where they treated him with herbs and things. And I was shooting all this time. And there was only one guy who was helped to pull him. And I had to think whether I was going to keep shooting or help the guy. And so I kept shooting, and then they put him in this little clinic, and I photographed through the window while they had to amputate his leg. And I felt very strange, because I felt I could have helped, but I didn't help. But then I also felt elated that I was getting a shot that would be important to the film.
Looking back, are you sorry that you kept shooting instead of helping?
I try not to think about it, because mm-hmm. I rationalize out, well, how much help could you really be, you know? And maybe if people saw this, they'd realize the brutality of war and figure out there's got to be some better way than killing human beings who are just trying to farm a field.
You've done a lot of political documentaries, but you've also done hundreds of TV commercials. Is that a contradiction at all? Especially considering that the documentaries have been for, anti-imperialist causes. You've done a lot of documentaries in Vietnam, Central America. Mm-hmm. So is there any conflict in your mind between, selling your services for a lot of money to make commercials, and then, you know, doing things probably at your own expense that were documentaries about politics?
Well, there is a contradiction in a sense. If you're making commercials which sell products which are unhealthy or which are unnecessary, I think that you are part of a system. I am part of a system which encourages people to buy things and do things which are not to their best interest. And to that extent, you could say it was contradictory.
Some of the many commercials that you've shot over the years were for Marlboro cigarettes. You did a lot of the Marlboro Man campaign, right?
Oh.
Can you talk a little bit about getting... What? What were you going to say?
So you looked me up pretty good.
Yeah, we got your number. But I'm really interested, you know, since that became such an iconic commercial, and then it became so controversial afterwards because one of the Marlboro men got cancer, lung cancer. So can you talk a little bit about creating the image, creating the icon?
Well, of course, the general idea was dreamed up by the advertising agency. And so the... my job was to realize that. And we went down to Lubbock, Texas, usually, and onto a ranch, and we'd pick cowboys who looked the part, and photograph them under dramatic situations, you know, rounding up wild horses or running through streams, and then reaching in and taking a drag on a cigarette. Now, I have to, in my defense, I have to say that the general knowledge of the deadly nature of cigarettes was not primarily in my mind, nor was it on these poor cowboys, who many of whom have died of emphysema since we were shooting. I do notice that American tobacco companies have big campaigns overseas now, and we are making cigarette addicts out of millions of Chinese, and without the necessity of putting any Surgeon General report on them.
When you were younger, you joined the Merchant Marines. Why did you go to sea?
Well, it was patriotic, for one thing. It was just the beginning of World War II, and my dad had been in the Navy, and I preferred that from my image of digging around in the mud like a grunt. I would prefer fighting the war from ships.
Mm-hmm. Now, a ship that you were on was torpedoed. I believe this was off the coast of Africa. And you were wounded, and you were on a lifeboat for 14 days with, I believe, 17 other men. Is that right? Do I have that right?
I don't know where you're reading all this stuff, but it's pretty accurate. Yes, it was in 1942. I was on a ship called the Excello, coming back from the Red Sea, and we were sunk off the coast of Africa by a German submarine. And was in a lifeboat for 14 days and landed and lived with the Pondos in South Africa who took care of us and took care of me. I had some wound in my left leg.
Just give me a sense of what it was like to be on that raft for 14 days. Were you sitting? Were you lying? Was there room for your whole body to stretch out? Were you in a lot of pain?
Well, I was, I think I was 19. And we were in a lifeboat, not in a raft, and we were jammed in. And the first couple of nights were difficult because there were heavy swells, and I had a thing like a bicycle pump, which is a bilge pump like thing to pump the water that was coming in the lifeboat. And I had one of the guys, the saloon messman, I asked him to hold the hose over the side because it had a curl in it, and I had to pump, and I pumped with my right arm till it gave out, and pumped to my left until it gave out, and then I noticed that he had collapsed and that the hose was not going over the side of the lifeboat but went back into the lifeboat. And I think that was the only time that I really felt like I wanted to give up. Mm-hmm. And then we had chief engineer, who a guy named Finnegan, who came back. He was an older guy, and he came back because we needed chief engineers at that time, and he died on the boat. And another guy and I had to decide whether he was really dead. You know how in the movies they just sort of reach down and look at somebody and they say, oh, he's dead. Well, it's not that easy, at least it wasn't for us. And so after putting things in front of his mouth and trying, we realized he was dead. And so a guy named Milt McCord and I had to dump him over the side. And that was a rough time, because he was a good guy, and it's the first time I really was close to anyone dying.
And you had to be the one to declare that he was dead, and you weren't even.
Well, most.
That's certain.
Besides Milt McCord and I, two guys in the boat, were about the strongest, in best conditions. A lot of the guys had swallowed a lot of oil, and some of them had gotten shrapnel from the. When the torpedo went off. And so we were sort of in charge of the boat.
Do you think that you had the courage to do certain things you might not have done if it wasn't for that experience?
I do. I think that it gave me a really strong feeling of my life force. and a confidence in myself. I felt like I was a man. Before that point, for some reason, I always felt I was a boy. In fact, they called me the baby on the ship because I was the youngest guy on the ship. But I always felt that way. And then I felt that experience, because of the responsible nature that I found I acted all during that traumatic time, that I felt that I was a man.
Was being a cinematographer on commercial films any more gratifying earlier in your career, or is it more gratifying now? I'm wondering, in other words, how much the industry has changed, and if you have any more or less freedom, if you enjoy the films you're making any more or less.
The business has changed, and I use the word business very carefully, because when I first started making features, people made features because they wanted to make that picture, because that picture said something about humanity, said something about human relations, said something about something. Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't make pictures to make money, but the commercial aspects of what is a good picture, a successful picture, has overridden what I think is some of the artistic benefits of movie making. That doesn't mean, I mean, I'm always surprised how many good pictures do get made, but the avalanche of pictures which are presented because of testing, because of trying to reach a certain audience in a certain way, leads to prefabricated ideas and repetitious ideas that don't really elevate the whole stature of motion picture business.
Well, Haskell Wexler, I wish we had more time to talk. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
A retrospective of Haskell Wexler's work will be presented by the Museum of the Moving Image in New York from April 3rd through the 25th. Wexler will speak at the museum on April 17th and 18th. He's featured in a new documentary about cinematographers called Visions of Light, and that will be shown at New York's Film Forum April 2nd through the 8th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.